Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors.
Hello, and welcome to Travel Medicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Hey, y'all. This is your funky pediatric infectious disease doc and researcher, Dr. Santosh. I don't know where it came from. It just,
Is that a Mardi Gras voice? Is that a Gambit from X-Men? Where are we going with this?
I don't know. I was just feeling funky.
I guarantee.
Hey, can I do a quick shout out? On the day of recording this, probably not the day that we are releasing this, happy International Women's Day, one and all. I'm sorry, by the way, if I'm ruining the magic that you think that this is being all done like spontaneously and live. For people
Santosh,
who think that's happening.
If you're a true feminist, every day is International Women's Day.
I'm not doing this with you right now. Yeah, please do, you know, thank the wonderful women in your life to take this day of appreciation. And yeah, it's a good day.
So lately, I have been thinking about sound. We already covered fast food medicine and taste, and I'm moving through the senses. Let's see if I can remember. The sense of sight is what guides us right when we go out on walks. The sense of smell's the way you tell that you need to change your socks. The sense of touch is what hurts so much when you bang your toe on the bed. Now, the sense of hearing is something good, because if a tree falls in the wood, would there be a sound? You bet there would. If it landed on top of your head, if a tree lands on top of your head, do 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 do, and that brings us to today's topic: not trees, not heads, but sound.
Yeah, huge ups to the Animaniacs. For my money, one of the greatest modern educators outside of schools. I learned so much.
Oh,
from the Animaniacs.
Thank you, Santosh. You shouldn't. Oh, you meant the cartoon.
Yeah, but you were quoting, I believe that was Yakko Wakko Dot, right? Yeah,
it was.
Okay.
So this week, it's been a little while, listening audience, but I felt like it was time for us to do an alternate week. And you know what happens.
Oh my gosh.
And you know what happens on alternate weeks.
Oh, I'm so excited.
It's time for Kermit arms in the air.
Uh-huh.
Alternate week journal club. Yay!
Yay! Oh, I think I just located something.
Now, for those of you who took a look at the episode title, you may be wondering what sound can have to do with brains, balls, and avoiding falls.
Brains I can totally get. You know, we have our cranial nerve 8, our vestibulocochlear nerve that goes straight into our temporal lobes. And you know, after it gathers all the sound, it translates it into, you know, something meaningful for us. The balls and falls, I'm not sure about, though. You're going to have to teach me.
So let's start with the easiest application of sound in medicine. Mm-hmm. Ultrasound.
Oh, yeah. this is a little bit of a stretch here. They are sound waves. They're sound waves. They're just sound waves that our human ears can't perceive as sound.
Unless you have ultra ears, which we don't. So yeah. As a way to see inside the body, ultrasound has been around since the early 1900s.
Yes.
Usually we use it to do things like reveal fetuses or look at collections of fluid or juicy steaks. And we will get to the history of ultrasound at some point. But this is a journal club. So yeah. I'm going to tell you about a little bit of research going on, and neuroscientists now have a newer ambition for the technology, which is tinkering with the brain.
Oh, okay. Now, I will say that we do use ultrasound, Josh, to look at the brain in young babies. So those kids who are in our neonatal intensive care unit, and you want to see how their brain health is doing from the standpoint as if there are any bleeds or anything like this, because they have that fontanelle, right? The bones in their skull haven't fused yet. You have that little window or a little soft spot. That right there, you can put an ultrasound probe in. You know, you bounce the sound waves off of there. It comes, back to the probe on the surface of the scalp, and you can see it. So I do use ultrasounds on brains.
Well, I was going to say we can already modulate the brain non-invasively by delivering electric current or magnetic pulses. That's known as transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's usually used to treat a lot of mental health disorders like obsessive compulsive or depression or migraines. But using ultrasound is kind of a new application. And in the 1950s, we had some experiments that first showed ultrasound waves could suppress neural activity in a visual region of the cat brain. And in rodents, aiming the ultrasound at motor regions can trigger movements like a paw or a whisker twitch, so reflexes.
That's a little scary.
And focusing it on the frontal regions of monkey brains change how the animals perform at moving their eyes or tracking.
Okay.
So now, of course, ultrasound is just waves of sound that you change the frequency or modulation, like dialing in on your radio. And at very high intensities, when the sound waves are very, very close together, ultrasound can actually heat up and kill cells, including brain cells, which is a feature neurosurgeons have exploited to burn away sections of the brain responsible for tremors.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. But in that case, this is an intraoperative technique. So you don't want to use the probe sitting, you know, outside of the skull and then trying to aim these sound waves like this. This is a very, very small focused probe that you use after you actually expose the brain. And then you put the probe exactly where you want to put it and emit those sound waves, right?
And it's not that it wouldn't work if you did it through the skull. It's just that you'd cook a lot of the brain along the way.
Right.
So it has to be a very focus. So you want to be touching right up against your target area. So in a preprint on, I hate when they do this, BioRxiv.
BioArchive.
It's a stupid way of spelling archive.
Archive. It goes back all the way to mathematics and physical sciences. That's where they've been publishing for a very long time. Very recently, we've been making more use of BioArchive and MedArchive for preprint.
Well, anyway, a team reported that exposing mouse neurons in a dish to ultrasound can actually open up calcium ion channels and render them more excitable. So it can start essentially making neurons fire, not just burning the cells out.
Oh, okay.
And a different study done by Virginia Polytechnic Institute showed focused ultrasound, again, could increase electrical activity in sensory processing regions, improving the ability of participants to discern the number of points being touched on their fingers. Now, this is a fine discrimination test. Take your thumb, you can tap it against the tips of each of your fingers. If you do it very quickly, you kind of start losing the sensation of which finger is touching, unless you're a guitarist.
Yeah.
But if you aim focused ultrasound at somebody without being, you know, already in their skull, you can actually improve their ability to determine, you know, that fine motor touch.
Wow. That's really neat. So our fingertips do have something called two-point discrimination. So if you have, you know, something as sharp as a needle, and you, you know, if you, you know, go and go, actually you could try this at home if you want. If you have two sharpened pencils and you put them right next to each other, your fingertips actually can determine if you're touching with those two sharpened tips or if you're going with one, because we have that discrimination. Other areas of our skin don't. It's not as fine. But you're saying that you can kind of turn up that power.
You can, but you have to be careful about what you turn it up to, because ultrasound experiments that we described in animals, the ones that made paw twitches in mice or things like that, use intensities way, way higher than what is currently allowed for human use. And that's because there's two big dangers of ultrasound that are only dangers at frequencies that we don't use in medicine. So this is not like, you know, if you're going to have a regular ultrasound, this is not something you need to worry about.
But yeah, in this those have been used, unfortunately, by, you know, the military and that kind of a thing for, you know, nefarious applications. So, but yeah, tell us how about we can actually focus it to for good and not hurting.
So we talked about, you know, if you use high intensities, you have the potential to heat up cells and essentially cook the brain. Another way of causing damage is through something called cavitation, the creation of tiny bubbles in tissue.
Yeah. One of my favorite aminals of all time, Josh, uses cavitation in order to attack. That's the mantis shrimp. If anyone goes and looks up the mantis shrimp and how they do this little punch, like a pow, like that, basically they're moving the water so quickly that they create a hole, like a little cavity where the water was, because they just snap, snap, like that. And that area, that center, gets really, really hot and releases a lot of energy at once.
Yeah, you're collapsing a little vacuum. You're creating almost a tiny black hole.
Yeah. Physicists may have something different to say about that, but oh yeah.
Yeah, but analogists will go with me on this one.
Hell yeah.
So when you start looking at one of the things people are doing in terms of using cavitation and heating, some Cohen and collaborators recently tested the safety of these higher intensity ultrasounds in people by aiming them at regions that were slated for surgical removal. So they're like, okay, even if we cook the brain, this part of it's being taken out anyway. So with the FDA's approval, they used intensities up to 8 times as high as the current limit for diagnostic ultrasound and found no significant damage to brain tissue or blood vessels surrounding it.
They knew that because they could do this technique. The surgeon would take out that area of the brain anyway, and then you can just examine it under the microscope.
So we don't know whether or not ultrasound targeted at the brain would be useful to treat epilepsy. What we do know is that using it at those high levels that could cause ablation of brain tissues is not causing any significant damage to the blood vessels surrounding. Because again, if you're going to start aiming a probe through somebody's skull without cutting into it, you want to be very certain of what effect you're having.
Yes. So there's the thought of, affecting the neurons themselves. That's important. But there's lots of other cell types in the brain, and of course there's a blood supply. If you disrupt the vascular tissue, if you disrupt the blood vessels, well, you get a bleed. And bleeds in the brain are very bad. Direct blood is toxic to neurons, and you'll start to get death of those neurons very quickly, and formation of scar tissue and everything else that goes on with it. The worst example of that is a hemorrhagic stroke. So you definitely don't want to have any potential for that in this type of a technique.
Now, interestingly that you mentioned stroke, this can also be explored as a way of resensitizing you to feeling. So you may lose some sensation or have numbness in a limb post-stroke. Well, a different researcher, George, last name, not first. A different researcher, George, was looking at ultrasound to reduce pain and found something interesting. His team applied increasing heat to the arms of 19 participants who tended to become more and more sensitive over repeated tests. That's hypersensitization, reporting pain at much lower temperatures by the last test. But if in between the first test and the last test of applying heat to them, they had pulses of ultrasound aimed at the thalamic region of their brain, so the thalamus, the pain threshold would dip to half as much, meaning you basically reset the test to the original levels.
Okay. So they were able to tolerate more pain or more heat if you aimed at the thalamus.
Their systems basically forgot that they were being sensitized and restarted. This is, if I'm giving you the most flimsy analogy or equivalent, this is how we start getting the Men in Black memory sticks.
Oh, the,
the neuralizers.
Gotcha. But very specifically for threshold of pain.
Right, because it resets, it makes the body forget that it was becoming sensitized to pain, so it starts again. And it's done with nothing but sound waves. So the neuralizer, where they held up a little flash of light and blanked your memory, we are now on the first step on that road to making that a reality. It's a very long road. But we have made the first step to causing memory changes or brain alterations with nothing but sound.
That's really, really amazing. But even, you know, for the application of forgetting about what stimuli causes how much pain and resetting that threshold, everybody's, you know, at some point in time, cut themselves, burned themselves, right? The next time that area gets injured, if it's, you know, if that area is still healing up, it hurts much more than it would if it hadn't been injured in the first place. This is sensitization. And this is a problem with people with, you know, chronic pain. You know, everyone says, oh, if you're in chronic pain, then, you know, you get used to it. Absolutely not. It's worse. So this application, Josh, in and of itself would be very, very useful. And I know you have, you know, probably thoughts about this with your interest in palliation and comfort care.
Yeah, and I'm going to just start carrying a neuralizer around and aiming it at all my chronic pain patients. Poof, fixed forever.
There's no way that this could, you know, like turn... like, this is your villain origin story, isn't it?
This is my villain origin? My villain origin was years ago. Let's move on to our next topic. So we covered brains. I believe I owe you a medical story about sound and balls.
Is this going to get euphemistic?
No, we're going to go straight to the heart of the matter and to talk about using ultrasound for speedy sperm.
I just asked you if you were using ball as a euphemism for something, and you just lied to me.
I thought you meant, was I going to beat around the bush?
Oh, okay. If you were gonna try to sell it to me gently type of a thing. All right, yeah.
Nope, just there they are, right in your face.
So I'm guessing this is going to be a similar concept to the right frequency and intensity could stimulate neurons. So probably the same thing for like a sperm.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we're talking about using ultrasound on our other heads, as it were, exposing immobile sperm to ultrasound wave actually gets them moving. Sperm that don't move properly are one of the key causes of infertility, as lazy sperm have a harder time reaching the egg. So this is a technique that could improve the success rate of in vitro fertilization, which has been coming up in the news a lot lately, given that Alabama has decided the freezer section is full of people.
God. Absolute insanity. Those of you outside of the United States of America and where you couldn't possibly conceive of the government being so damn weird and stepping on medical science in this way, please spare a tear for us.
So we will do a future episode on in vitro fertilization, but for now let's talk about just our speedy sperm. So previous research has suggested that high-frequency ultrasound increases the motility of sperm. Again, high-frequency meaning it can cook rat it can, you know, stimulate rat neurons, cook brain cells. But this first study didn't really involve isolating the sperm to look at which individual cells would benefit. It's just like, oh, you know, bombard sperm with sound and they seem to move faster. So a researcher in Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, separated 50 semen samples into three groups of rapid movers, slow movers, and immotile or non-movers based on guidelines that assess swimming velocity. So you've got your Michael Phelps, your average swimmers, and then, like, I don't know, me.
Yeah. I'm imagining him with like just the tiniest little, you know, like a toothpick. And then, you know, just because you just said it, like swimming lanes like that, he just very, okay, you're going into lane one over there, just like one at a time. Like that's the first half year of this project, just with a teeny tiny pair of
building the teeny tiny Olympic pools. Oh my goodness.
Oh, absolutely. Do you think they could have teeny tiny like water polo?
Who would be riding the sperm?
No. Not that kind of polo, like water polo, like the swimmers. Because then, in that case, the sperm could hit the ball instead of the. Sorry, okay, I'm gonna get very punchy in about 2 minutes and immature. So you better carry us on.
after separating individual sperm cells from the semen samples.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Researchers measured the motility of the cells both before and after they were exposed to ultrasonic waves at a power of 800 milliwatts. Great Scott. And a frequency of 40 megahertz. Now, those numbers will reappear a little bit later, but that's what I want you to keep in mind. 40 megahertz, 800 milliwatts. That's how long they bombarded. Or that's the amplitude of frequency they bombarded the sperm at for 20 seconds. Okay.
Yeah. So wattage is power, right? And frequency is how high the pitch is. This is way outside of the pitch of human hearing. And then of course the megawatts is quite powerful. You know, you don't want to be in position.
Jumping gigawatts, Marty. So after these 20 seconds of ultrasound exposure, over 59% of the immotile sperm became slow moving. So you took them from not going at all to actually moving, and some even got a hyper boost and started to swim rapidly.
Ooh, oh. So the sound wave was kind of like that, you know, when you're on Mario Kart. Yeah. And then you hit the little ramp, you go, pew! Like that. So we went to sperm. It was like that.
So
Josh, We have to invent a little sperm eraser game and sell it to Nintendo.
This change in sperm motility after ultrasound exposure and repeated exposure peaked at a 266% increase in movement speed.
Holy crap, that's fast.
So you went from, like, you know, casual sit on the couch sperm to Usain Bolt.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
They
still don't quite know the mechanism behind why this works. They think that the ultrasound improves any dysfunction in the sperm's mitochondria, which are their little power stations that drive them. But it's still a very early study. Just interesting that, you know, again, we may be able to rely on ultrasound not only to look at babies, but to help make them.
Yeah. Now, there are some caveats here, right? As you said, on the male side, one of the most common causes of infertility is slow-moving sperm. You do have to, in order for an ultrasound technique like this to work, have spermatozoa that have all of their, you know, their mechanisms intact, that they can actually swim if stimulated. There are other cases where the flagella, or actually the body or the head of the sperm, any of those kind of things are actually defunct. So you can apply ultrasound all day and they're just, you know, they're not going to move properly because the actual swimmy thingy called the flagella is actually broken, as an example. So that wouldn't work. But in the cases where you just need to, like, add speed, now, you know, thinking about this way ahead of time, right now this is just, you know, understanding it in a small microfluidics chamber. I don't know how, Josh, you would get those type of ultrasound waves onto your little swimmers without causing quite a bit of discomfort to the man holding those sperms.
You are clearly unfamiliar with the wide selection of adult entertainment toys that are sonically driven.
Oh, God. Why are you doing this right now?
I'm just saying, like, using sound waves is something that a lot of industries have already taken advantage of. So the idea that you would just have to take some of the existing, I don't know, if there was perhaps some sort of adult entertainment toy that relied on vibration, perhaps.
Okay.
if only there was one, and you could take this, we'll call it a vibrating device, and
yeah,
increase its amplitude or frequency so it sends out ultrasonic waves that could then promote, that could then improve fertility. Now, again, there can be a lot of causes of infertility. This is only affecting this particular one, but it's one that would be very easy to translate into a real world setting once the studies are a little bit more concrete.
I definitely see that. What I'm thinking about is some of the, you know, in our previous article, you were talking about if the intensity of a sound wave is, you know, at a particular level, you actually get, you know, cell death in the case of neurons. So I'm presuming that, you know, applying this ultrasound is going to, you know, it's going to heat up a little bit and cause, you know, some maybe not fun feelings. So I don't know,
Santosh,
that this would be
20 seconds.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Is your Yeah, but it's 20 seconds of and then you have to perform. I'm learning about this.
20 seconds of yes.
Yeah, for some people it's 20 seconds of and then you go to town.
No, it's 20 seconds, 20 seconds of vibration prior to the act itself.
Right.
And when there are I don't know how much heat is being generated in that time.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like this is very doable.
I'm presupposing, because I actually don't know where the cell death thresholds are for a given cell, and the ultrasound amplitude or power, the wattage and the frequency that would cause that, versus something that I don't know. A person may not even feel anything when this ultrasound is applied.
So as long as we're talking stories of brains and balls and babies and memory, let's see if we can find some study that'll allow us to combine all of those. Looks like there's a couple early reports that taking Viagra may lower your risk for Alzheimer's.
Come on. How many segues did you have to ride? I mean, this is fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. But this may be a bridge too far.
You act like I don't build entire episodes around one flimsy pun.
This is so cool. By the way, if this pans out in the long term, this is like win-win-win for so many human beings.
So yeah. Ruth Brower at University College London looked at anonymous medical records of over 270,000 men in the UK for age 40 or older who had a new diagnosis of erectile dysfunction.
Gotcha.
Those who went on to get prescriptions for Viagra or any Viagra-like drug, those who went on to get prescriptions for Viagra had an 18% chance, an 18% lower chance of then being diagnosed with Alzheimer's over the next 5 years. The erectile dysfunction diagnosis came first. Then,
I swapped my ED and my AD. Sorry.
Is that a problem for you frequently?
If you're about to make an ironic Alzheimer's erectile dysfunction joke at my expense, yeah, go ahead and do it, because that's going to get us so many clicks.
I already made the joke. You clearly forgot already.
I just Alzheimer'd this whole Alzheimer's.
Let's try that again.
Let's try it again. Try it again. Okay, so she started off looking at over 200,000 and around 270,000 men with erectile dysfunction.
Yes. Then
got it. Okay.
Of those men, the ones who got prescriptions for Viagra or similar drugs had an 18% lower chance of being diagnosed with Alzheimer's over the next 5 years.
Oh,
meaning
wow.
There is a correlation. That's our famous buzzword, correlation between Viagra and decreased risk for Alzheimer's. Now, let's talk a little bit more about that. These drugs work, Viagra, I mean, works by raising levels of a signaling molecule called cyclic GMP, CGMP. Now, that dilates blood vessels and boosts blood flow to the penis. Animal research has shown that these drugs also dilate blood vessels to the brain.
Okay.
Which means if you are taking something that dilates blood vessels all over your body or in very specific areas, that may be the mechanism. Dilated blood vessels in the brain could also make it easier for those cleaning cells to clear out the neurofibrillary tangles or plaques that contribute to Alzheimer's. It could increase blood flow in general, meaning you stay sharper for longer. And I believe you even use some of these kinds of things in babies, again, to open up blood vessels in lungs or brains as well.
Okay, gotcha. All right. Okay, so these were, by the way, she was focusing on people with erectile dysfunction, right? It was very interesting here, Josh. They had to go from 2000 to 2017 because you know what happened in March 31st of 2017? So they set the end of the exposure there because about a year later, you could get sildenafil over the counter. So she couldn't track the prescriptions anymore. So the comparison groups were all of the people in this study were people with erectile dysfunction, but she was basically looking at those men with ED who got prescribed sildenafil versus those who did not. So essentially, she's kind of sort of looking at, you know, if you had a phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitor on board or whether you didn't, and trying to think about that effect on dementia.
Now, a brief comment on studies. The best form of medical evidence comes from randomized trials. So that would be hundreds of men would either be given Viagra or placebo, and then you'd compare their rates of Alzheimer's. But this study that we're describing is an observational study. That's the other main kind. That's where scientists just look at records to look for different patterns of behavior, like using Viagra or not, and seeing what kind of health outcomes that correlates with. They're a lot easier and cheaper to do than randomized trials, especially when you're trying to do long-term studies, but they are a little prone to bias because there could be a third factor linked with Viagra use that could be protective. For example, exercise. People who are going out and buying Viagra are probably looking to get a lot more physical activity into their life, and increased exercise is also known to be or also correlated with being protective against Alzheimer's. So we can't jump straight to start popping the little blue pill for the big red brain. But
yeah, so because this was a chart review, right, and she wasn't able to get all of the information you want to clinically, she was able to take a look at, you know, as many confounding variables as possible, such as alcohol use, smoking, weight, blood pressure, and comorbidities, as well as the use of other medications that would be common in this population. So, you know, this was the best attempt possible looking retrospectively at this type of a population. And Josh, I think the best way to describe a study like this is it's grounds for investigating this more, not to come to a conclusion.
Exactly. Again, you know, you shouldn't be telling Pop Pop to run out and go do this to protect himself. But if he's already doing it, maybe he's going to remember what Gram Gram looks like for a bit longer.
Yeah. Cheers.
Do you think I offended enough people with that? Can we move on to the next study?
I don't think it's any offense. It's just, you know, terribly, terribly juvenile. And we're making light of a very, very severe and scary disease.
But that's,
which is not at all like us.
That's why you come to Journal Club for serious science.
It is a very, very interesting observation to make. I think the effect that Dr. Ruth and et al. Found is a very interesting one to pursue. Dr. Josh is absolutely right. This is not going to be grounds for starting like FDA approval of sildenafil to fight Alzheimer's disease. But we may be able to look at, prospectively moving, the role of phosphodiesterase 5 and CGMP in the development of Alzheimer's disease in aging men. I think that's cool.
Moving on to our next study, and we haven't done a journal club in a while, so this is, I'm kind of cramming them all in here because ain't nobody got time for that.
Yeah, so, someone's already like cranked us up to like 1.75x on there, you know.
So next comes an experimental treatment for Alzheimer's that has been in early use that might also help cancer patients. So this is a treatment for Alzheimer's that involves flickering lights and low-pitched sound to help prevent cognitive problems. That's right. We send old people to a rave.
Yeah. Yes. This makes me so happy. Go ahead. Continue.
Now, it shows that involving these flickering lights and low-pitched sounds may also help prevent cognitive problems following cancer treatment. Now, this is something called chemobrain. Have you ever heard of this, Santosh?
I have. I've seen it in action. It's less impactful in our pediatric population just because they're more resilient. But by the way, this is not for neurological tumors even. It could be for treating leukemia, but we know that there's going to be some effect on even non-dividing cells, like those in your brain, largely non-dividing once it's matured. And essentially, there's this kind of, cognitive impairment. They fall behind on like mathematics scores and language scores and ability scores. And it's one of those things that it's a really scary side effect that you don't know about until much later.
So if we take this light treatment, the lights will flicker 40 times a second or 40 hertz, also with a sound frequency of 40 hertz. Now, if you recall, where did we last hear that? That's how fast we used it to speed up sperm. And a 40 hertz light is essentially a strobe light.
Yeah.
So by exposing people to a strobe light, and the reason this was originally selected is not just because it was the same as a strobe light, it's that people with Alzheimer's have a lower intensity of 40 hertz brainwaves, and those are linked with memory processing. So the idea was, if you stimulate them with sounds at 40 hertz, you're going at the same wave as memory processing brainwaves, and you could perhaps stimulate memory.
Oh, cool. Okay. It's not going to be a perfect correlate, but that's kind of neat. It's worth examining is what you're saying.
Yeah. So Li Hui Cai at MIT developed the approach and wondered if it could help people with cancer who have memory and concentration problems after chemotherapy. So he started testing this in mice who they were non-cancerous mice who he gave chemotherapy, so they'd get that sort of chemo brain. Then he exposed them to a 40 times a second flickering light with a sound frequency of 40 hertz and looked at their memory sharpness. And this was assessed with a memory test that exposed mice to objects that were either novel, meaning new, or familiar. And the animals would show more interest in items they hadn't seen before. So if you give a mouse a cookie, then he'll ask for a glass of milk. But if you keep giving a mouse a cookie, eventually he's going to get bored of the cookie. And if you present him with a carrot, he'll say, ooh, something new. So chemotherapy reduced mice's abilities to discriminate between objects. They'd say, I've seen both this carrot and this cookie. I'm not terribly interested in either. But if you then gave them the sound and light treatment, that improved their ability. It prevented that loss of discrimination.
Oh, very, very nice. Okay, gotcha.
Now, again, these are early, early studies, so the amount of time that you would have to expose somebody on cancer or somebody on chemo to this to prevent their chemo brain still needs to be worked out, as mouse brains and human brains still have quite a number of differences, ratatouille aside.
Yeah. And there was a bit of a caveat here where giving this kind of therapy, kind of during the chemotherapy itself, so you overlapped the sound and light therapy with chemotherapy, showed the benefit. But if you waited 90 days out, right, after the chemo was done, you couldn't recover the function that you wanted to. You only had very limited benefit at that point. So, thinking about how to use this, is that you'd have to kind of recognize that a person would be getting a chemo brain. And hopefully, you know, if this is a low risk procedure, you'd be giving it kind of with the chemo.
Preferably to some sort of electronica music.
If infusion centers across America turned into rave houses, Josh, it's like,
I mean, it's the only natural conclusion.
Like, you just, you walk past, you know, someone, you know, like dressed like Blade, and you're like, oh, are they going to a party? No, man, they're going to get chemo. Stop being an asshole.
I would love to see
the cyclist boring.
I would love to see the overlap in the chemo and rave worlds, especially with the especially with the candy kids and baggy pants.
I didn't, when we were talking about sound waves and sensation, I didn't make the "I can't feel my face when I'm with you" joke. I guess it would kind of sort of fit here, except, you know, because this is the rave part. And then
well, again, if we if we start thinking about, you know, cancer centers turning into raves,
yeah,
the population of these raves is going to be very different, because rave is traditionally a young person's game.
Sure, sure.
But if you start if you start sending the elderly to chemo centers filled with these Alzheimer's alternating light therapy, and then you bombard their brains with ultrasound, we want to make sure that they don't fall. And you know what? There's a great way to train them for those future cancer raves.
Oh, you and your segues.
And that brings us to our last study, which, if I'm being perfectly honest, is some version of this study has been released and repeated every year since about 2011.
This particular, what's old is new type of thing.
Yeah, like this particular study is new, but when I started researching it, this has been a topic of study for about a decade now. And that is using some form of Dance Dance Revolution to prevent falls in the elderly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I'll put this out there. Dance in general, especially partner dancing, and, you know, kind of put within a framework. So Argentine tango, for instance, has been used for cognitive training to delay deterioration in Alzheimer's. It's definitely been shown to have beneficial effects. But as a whole body trainer, especially to get balance and proprioception and all this kind of things moving, dance is absolutely amazing. Everyone out there, dance like nobody's watching.
No, you're talking about a kind of dance that requires a great deal of skill and possibly training, and I'm talking about a Japanese video game introduced in 1998.
Oh my god, Josh, are you taking us to DDR?
Yes, that's literally what Dance Revolution. What?
Oh, like that. I mean, you said like Japanese dance thing. That's the first thing I think of, is because we used to play that in medical school with the pad.
Yeah.
We used to look absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, Dance Revolution.
So for those of you who didn't get an opportunity to play this or go to an arcade, Dance Dance Revolution has a a pad that you stand on with four or occasionally six four or eight directional arrows.
Directional arrows, yeah. So, you know, forward, backwards, left, right. And then if you want to get funky with it, it's got the diagonals as well, yeah.
And then a screen that plays music and has arrows dropping down. And when the arrow reaches the bottom of the screen, you're supposed to step on the corresponding foot pad. And it gets you doing little choreographed versions in a very small area to popular songs of the day.
It's so much fun. And the best thing about it is that you get to dance like a crazy person, and you know, you get whatever you score, and then you get to sit down and watch your friends look like really weird when they're trying to hit these squares. But this is like the challenging version, right? When it's, you know, it's actually difficult. I'm presuming you're going to tune down the difficulty a bit for our friends dementia.
I'm glad you noted the difficulty, because even for young people, a lot of the machines quickly, after only about a year, added a little bar on the back of the stage for you to hold on to, so you didn't fling yourself off the stage trying to dance or jump.
Yeah, or you know, at least to give you a little bit of a bump in case you were to fall. Yeah, it's a little fall support kind of thing. It works most of the time. Sometimes people just flip the hell right over the back of the thing.
But seeing games that emphasized movement and pattern recognition, following the arrows, anticipating where it will be, positioning yourself, all of that has been kind of used again and again in studies for multiple sclerosis, for Parkinson's, for any sort of movement disorder. So in this particular study, a researcher, Sterniaks and her colleagues, recruited 769 people aged 65 or over, some or most of who had a history of falls. They were split into three groups, and they all received a workbook on how to prevent falls. One of the groups was told to use their proprietary DDR, which was called Smart Step.
They couldn't get the licensing for the actual thing, huh?
Or they're trying to sell their own version. Who knows?
Okay.
But
scientists got to eat.
One of the groups was told to use Smart Step. Another was given just an unnamed cognitive-based game, also designed to prevent falls, but you would play it while you were seated. And the third group, you know, so you have workbook group, you have seated group, and you have standing dancing group. Each group was encouraged to play their respective game for at least 2 hours a week for 1 year. 2 hours a week is not a lot of time to devote to a game.
Yeah, that's, you know, if you want to get really good at something like that, that's, you know, that you need more time.
Compared with the group that was just given the workbook, those in the Smart Step group fell significantly less over the year. And I linked you to that study. There was no overall difference between the workbook and the seated group. But among those with a history of falls, those who played the seated game fell less often. So even that small amount did show some improvement if you already had a history. If you didn't, then really standing up and dancing was the best. So the takeaway from this is, after Pop has taken his Viagra and aimed whatever vibrating toy, you should go and film a TikTok video with him, a bunch, because each of those TikTok dances is going to improve and make it much less likely that your grandparents and parents will fall, and keeps you all invested, because we played Dance Dance Revolution growing up. Now people do TikTok dances, and really it's something that can bring us all together.
Yeah. It cannot be emphasized enough. I know that there's a lot of discussion about activity and dementia and, problems with balance and coordination and all this kind of a thing. There is nothing more important really in life than to move. You have to move. And every time you take the time to do that somehow, you get cognitive benefits, you get motor benefits. I love these particular studies because you kind of codify, the way in which the person moves and stuff like that. So you you protocolize it with your own video game, in this case that they picked. But it doesn't make it any less true. It is so important. Everyone, you have to move it, move it.
I like to move it, move it. Do you like to move it, move it?
We all like to move it.
Move it.
Yeah. This is like the Madagascar, the lemurs, ring-tailed lemurs, right? Absolutely. Yes, we really should. I think the biggest takeaway from this episode, Josh, is, you know, whether it's at a rave or it's a video game or you grab a partner and swing around the dance floor or whatever it is, move because it will help your brain, it'll help your body. It's an all-around benefit.
But don't move in silence because all of these studies ultimately linked to sound in one way or the other.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, yeah. Have some, you know, fun lights, fun sounds. Yeah, make it a party, man. Party. Everything about all of these things make me so happy. This has been one of my favorite episodes.
And that's why people love our journal clubs. So that's it for this week. As always, we love to hear your comments, questions, and feedback. We are on TikTok, Facebook, X, any social media you can think of. We've probably found somewhere to go and be there, even if we're not always as dedicated to it as we should be. If you'd like to support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do that are in the show notes, along with links for further reading, such as these studies we've discussed. Our theme music is composed by Rachel Leisure. The show is produced by me with a lot of help from Dr. Santosh and friends. And until next time, as always, keep a song in your heart, soap on your hands, a shot in your arm, a spin on your globe. Find somewhere that's holding, I don't know, maybe a dance tournament. It's a competitive sport in Norway now. And once you've done all those things, happy travels.
Party on, everybody. Party on.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.